I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas.
What started in 2008 as an economic crisis morphed into a social crisis leading to mass unrest. And now, as revolutions turn into civil wars, creating military tension between nuclear superpowers, it has become a crisis of the global order.
This is Paul Mason, reading from his book, Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future.
If we can't create a sustainable global order and restore economic dynamism, the decades after 2050 will be chaos.
Paul Mason is the economics editor of Britain's Channel 4 television news. He's also a regular contributor to The Guardian and The New Statesman. And he doesn't mince words when it comes to what he sees as the dominant ideology right now, neoliberalism.
Neoliberalism is the doctrine of uncontrolled markets. The best route to prosperity is individuals pursuing their own self-interest, and the market is the only way to express that self-interest. It says the state should be small, except for its riot squad and secret police, that financial speculation is good, that inequality is good, that the natural state of humankind is to be a bunch of ruthless individuals competing with each other.
Paul Mason believes capitalism and neoliberalism, as we've come to know them, may have played their last hand.
I knew that a recession had begun. I'd just trekked across America filming the closure of 600 Starbucks branches. I knew there was stress in the global finance system. I'd reported concerns that a major bank was about to go bust 6 weeks before it happened. I knew the US housing market was destroyed. I'd seen homes in Detroit on sale for $8,000 cash. I knew, in addition to all this, that I didn't like capitalism. But I had no idea that capitalism, in its present form, was about to self-destruct.
Hello, Mr. Mason. You're coming through loud and clear and sounding good. Can you hear me?
Hi, it's Paul.
Hello, Paul. This is Paul here. Can you hear me?
I can. How are you doing?
Excellent. We finally made a connection. Actually, we could hear you for about a few minutes there.
Who knew what I was doing? Well, the wrong headphones on.
You were counting up and down a few times, and you started reading some of the readings that
I did.
Paul Mason joined me from London to talk about his book, Post-Capitalism. If you're comfortable,
let's just go straight ahead.
Yeah, you're an old pro, so we'll just march right along here.
We'll start with the readings.
On Ideas, a conversation with Paul Mason. Are we facing the end of capitalism? In the book, you say that capitalism is about to self-destruct. In fact, the book is called Post-Capitalism. That sort of implies just that. Haven't we heard that message at least once or twice or maybe a dozen times before?
Well, for 250 years, we've had economists predicting the end of capitalism. Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill, Karl Marx all discussed the problem of capitalism's self-reproduction. How much longer can it go on reproducing itself? Now, my analysis is based on the idea that it can go on for a long time as long as it can adapt, so that every time there's a downturn or any time a societal business model falls apart, what you usually get is a mixture of technological innovation and some changes in the structure of the economy, and we're off again. We're on a new upswing of growth.
But when did you get the idea that we'd come to the end of the line, that in fact there are no new upswings, that in fact we're now finished, it's done?
Well, by studying the old upswings. If you study the old upswings, we're talking about the 1840s in Britain, we're talking about the 1890s and the early 20th century, we're talking again after the Second World War. What you always see is this, what we call a synthesis of high-skilled work and high-value production, a technological synthesis. The problem is information technology makes that very difficult, I argue almost impossible to do, because information technology strips away value. Information technology allows us to produce things that could be and should be cheap or free. And so we're not making, as the Victor Record Company did in the 1910, 1911 period, a new product, the shellac record. We're making MP3 files, and it's very hard to make money out of them.
I can't help but notice, of course, you work for a newspaper called The Guardian, yep. Which is vaguely, I would say, to the left of center in the British newspaper world. You open your book and you talk about your open dislike of capitalism. So let me ask you, how much does your diagnosis, your prognosis for what's going to happen to capitalism, how are you sure that's not just wishful thinking?
Okay, I come from a town in the north of England called Lee, which once was very prosperous, had full employment, had coal mines and cotton mills, and had more or less had the same kind of society for about 200 years. It's one of the earliest industrial towns in the world. In the space of 20 years, its entire social fabric was ripped apart by neoliberalism. So I'm not going to like neoliberalism. But my critique of it begins from a determination to go beyond the moral and the outraged and the traditional left critique of capitalism. I argue that neoliberalism has in fact raised the human capacity quite significantly in the last 25 years. The problem is it can't go on raising it because the model is broken. So the idea that the kind of capitalism that emerged with Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan can go on is flawed and wrong because it's based on a series of flawed institutions, number one of which is financialized consumption. That is, we are borrowing to consume against wages that just don't rise. All that can happen when that happens, you get the expansion of the credit system and the stagnation of wages. All that can happen is that the credit system continually snaps back onto its real basis, which is people's incomes, and it destroys stuff. Right now in Europe, it is destroying employment. It is destroying growth. European growth is flatlining. To replace neoliberalism, we need something just as powerful and effective. Not just a bright idea about how the world could work, but a new, holistic model that can run itself and tangibly deliver a better outcome. It has to be based on micro-mechanisms, not diktats or policies. It has to work spontaneously. In this book, I make the case that there's a clear alternative, that it can be global and that it can deliver a future substantially better than the one capitalism will be offering by the mid-21st century. It's called post-capitalism.
This is actually something that you call fiat money, which is both at the cornerstone and it really is the major problem which is facing modern capitalism, according to you. Tell us about fiat money.
Okay. Fiat money is like fiat lux in the Bible. In the Bible, God says, let there be light. In the modern world, states say, let there be money. Now, since 1973, that money has not been linked to either precious metal like gold or to the real output of society. The supply of money is expandable ad infinitum by states. Now, to start with, that's good because it allows you to smooth over all the natural bumps in economic life. We called the 1990s the Goldilocks era because it was, for the first time in decades, neither too hot nor too cold. So you manage everything against trying to keep the economy just growing. But since 2000, we've seen the downside of this, because when we got the 1997 crash in Asia, then we got the dot-com crash 2000 and 2001, and then we had what we call the structured finance crash of 2008, the Lehman Brothers crisis. The response of policymakers is always to reach for the money supply. The problem is that's like treating the disease with the disease. What happens is the banks have to be bailed out, companies have to be bailed out, pension funds have to be bailed out. And over the past 15 years, we've seen the downside of neoliberalism. It cannot go on without continual pattern of boom and bust. which wipes out real stuff in the real economy.
I want to push you a bit on what you see as the crisis in capitalism and exactly what it is. You know, we have had a number of crises, and you itemized them. I mean, you know, it was the Asian crisis, then there was the dot-com crisis, and then there was the Lehman Brothers crisis. These are crises, but we seem to have gone through all of them. Why do you see the end is nigh?
The end is about 50 years away, so that's not nigh on anybody's timescale. Sure. We breezed through the Asian crisis, the dot-com crisis, the Lehman Brothers crisis by printing money, and we rely, after 2008, on China and Asia in general to take up the strain of driving world growth. It was predictable it would run out of steam. If you, like me, in my day job as an economics correspondent, were to sit watching the dials of the world economy, they are all taking a nosedive. The price of commodities, the price of oil, growth in China, growth and inflation in the Eurozone. So what does that mean long term? It doesn't mean immediately capitalism is finished. It just means that the dynamism in it is running out of steam. The OECD, this highly influential think tank of the top 20 economies in the world, predicts that by the middle of the century, we'll have gone through another four decades of this low or stagnant growth. And at that point, the problem is the stuff that's counterbalancing it, which is in the global south, in places like China and India, will also run out. That's the point. We really do need to start worrying about what economists call secular stagnation. That is stagnation that feeds off itself and is kind of like a global economy on life support. So to be absolutely clear, I don't predict that now. I'm quite happy to follow the highly influential and authoritative prediction by the OECD that around about 2050 is when we need to worry about it.
Okay, so it's down the road, but what is the response now? What should the response be? I mean, will states step in and try to defend the falling shreds of capitalism? What is going to happen?
Look, unannounced and largely misunderstood, something like 40 or 50 major actions have been taken by states in the world to limit trade. They never put a sign up saying, hey, we're going to limit trade. It's always some change in the local rules of what you can and cannot do. Right now, states are imposing trade restrictions to defend what? Jobs and growth in their own economies. Here in Britain, you've got the steelworkers agitating for, let's attack the Chinese for dumping steel into Europe. That's what they want, so they can defend their jobs. If you look at what the Chinese have done, they've cut the exchange rate of their own currency, and they've flooded the global market with cheap steel. And my concern is that that becomes an unstoppable deglobalization of the world. I am in favor of an equitable globalization. Better to save globalization and scrap neoliberalism. That gets us over the short-term problem. But the long-term problem is this lack of dynamism. And for that, here's where I begin to argue, you need a much more radical view of what is possible for capitalism as a whole. This is what leads me to believe that it would be better, once we've taken short-term anti-crisis measures, to start thinking about fostering a part of the economy that is not capitalist at all, that is not driven by the market, but is driven by collaboration and the production of stuff for free.
Well, in fact, it's the title of the book, what you call post-capitalism. I'd like you to define that for us.
Well, look, post-capitalism would be a state in economics where the majority of stuff is produced outside the market, cheaply or for free, by people whose work is not primarily rewarded with wages against the hours they've worked. It's a bit like people go on producing stuff when the price of it falls so low that if it were pure economics, they wouldn't go on producing it. That's when we know we've got post-capitalism. So to be absolutely clear, it's completely different pathway beyond capitalism than the old socialist proposal. The old socialist proposal was based on scarcity. So you got scarce electricity, you need a power station. You got scarce agricultural goods, you collectivize the agriculture. You ration stuff, you allocate stuff. The reason that didn't work was, first of all, it was tried very bureaucratically. And in countries that suffered from acute scarcity, like the Soviet Union, we don't need to relive the experiment. We can go route one to a society of abundance if we start with what is already abundant, which is information, and force that abundance into the real physical world.
I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas, and you're listening to my conversation with economist and journalist Paul Mason. Paul Mason counts himself among a growing number of thinkers, economists, writers, and activists, who reject the well-worn notion of a class struggle leading to a socialist revolution, but he nevertheless believes a more equitable society is possible. Here he is again reading from his book, Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future.
In 2008, something bizarre happened to Karl Marx. "He's back," shouted a headline in the London Times. The German publishers of Marx's Capital reported a 300% increase in sales after a government minister declared his ideas not so bad. Meanwhile, in Japan, a manga version of Capital went viral. In France, Nicolas Sarkozy was photographed leafing through the French edition of Marx's masterpiece.
It sounds vaguely utopian, if I must say so. I mean, not only is the critique of capitalism something that's been around for a while, so has the vision of people who have tried to see what will happen once capitalism goes away. And there have been many versions of that one, too.
Yeah, I stand unashamedly in the tradition of the 19th century utopian socialists, except I don't think it's utopian, and I don't even think we have to go through the stage of socialism. We can go route one to what they were trying to do. They wanted to create societies that were highly human, defined by people's tendency to collaborate, to share, to do things altruistically, to give gifts into what we call a gift economy in the hope of some other gift coming back. That's what the people in the mid-19th century who formed these experimental communities were trying to do.
Who are we talking about? We're talking about Charles Fourier?
Charles Fourier with his, they were called phalanxes in North America, phalansters in France. We're talking about the English utopian socialist Robert Owen. Now, what was wrong with all the lot of them? They were trying to do this with two impediments. First of all, they were trying to live a life of abundance when there was actually scarcity. Next, they were trying to be real, fulfilled and rounded human beings from a starting point of where people were working 10, 12 hours a day in factories, where there was high domestic violence, huge amounts of ignorance, short lifespan. Those working class early utopian socialists were doomed to fail because both the human capital and the supply of goods was just not there. I noticed almost as soon as we could build online communities, we started building online replicas of utopian socialism. And in fact, for 20 years since the internet's been going, that's really what we've been trying to do.
How do you know, though, that capitalism isn't just a little bit smarter than you think it is, and that it'll figure out a way to adapt just as it has before, create capitalistic counterparts on the web?
Okay, it's trying to. The problem it's got is, number one, information technology corrodes the price mechanism. If you can produce something or reproduce it almost for zero cost, sooner or later, under conditions of competition, its price is going to fall to close to zero. Why is that a problem? You can't create new forms of high-value work faster than the old forms of low automated work are being wiped out. And you can't create in the information sphere, new high-value goods that retain their value unless you impose a massive and artificial monopoly into the market, such as the tech giants are currently doing. Let me give you an example. Information wants to be free, but the price of information-based physical goods is also collapsing. The price of a megabyte of storage, of a megabit of bandwidth, the price of all these things has collapsed over the last 10 years. The price of DNA sequencing is collapsing roughly at the same rate. So we're not just here talking about pure information goods. We're talking about physical things where the primary content or the primary value of that thing is the information that has been used to produce it.
This is it. You see, if we're not at the end yet, we're 50 years away from it.
Look, this is not a forced march destruction of capitalism scenario. It is the opposite. It is trying to educate people about what's happening, about the unstoppability of information as a new technology, and trying to get us to address in a kind of holistic and societal way what to do about jobs. If, as the Oxford University Institute that studies the internet say, 47% of all US jobs are able to be automated within 30 years, we have a big problem. We're going to have to do something about that. Let's redesign work. Let's share it out. The problem is we have a 4 billion year old planet and we have a 40,000 year old human society. And the last 200 years, that society caused the climate of the Earth to rise faster than we expected it to do. And we might have to think much more radically about what the solution, the economic solution to climate change is. But we are really going to have to probably dismantle the carbon-producing energy industries much more rapidly than we would like to.
I'm Paul Kennedy, and on Ideas, you're listening to journalist and political economist Paul Mason. We're asking the question, are we facing the end of capitalism? We'd like to know your thoughts on that very question. Is Paul Mason right? Are we heading for what he calls a post-capitalist future? You can contact us on both Facebook and Twitter to let us know. You can also let us know at cbc.ca/ideas, where you can always sign up for our podcast. In the book, you talk about an economist I'd actually never heard of before, a man named Nikolai Kondratiev.
Yeah.
And you say that Stalin actually had him executed. What is it about Kondratiev that interests you so much?
Nikolai Kondratiev is the first economist to find the economic equivalent of the black hole in space. This is 1922. He finds evidence that the industrial economy of capitalism has longer cycles within it than the business cycle we all are used to. So why is it important to find and explore these long cycles? Because they contain for me the clue as to how capitalism actually has survived. It survives by adapting what you might call a societal business model. Everybody is probably aware of the idea of a business model. So the business model of a big supermarket is different to the business model of a small local store. Societies have business models as well. So in the early 19th century, you had a business model based on high exploitation, child labor, slavery in the south of the United States. Well, that business model didn't work. It gets dismantled in the second half of the 19th century when you get to have prosperity based on high-skilled male manual work. Then you get the Ford Revolution, the so-called scientific management revolution of the early 20th century, and then you get the post-World War II global economic boom on steroids. These are four very discernible periods of history in which society goes through this total upswing. I argue, on the basis of Kondratiev's work, we are in the middle of a stalled fifth upswing, that we should be going through an upswing of technology, of lifestyles, of living standards, but we're not. We're stalled because we don't have the courage to deploy the technology. The technology could automate probably half of all jobs very quickly. We could robotize and automate and turn into artificial intelligence and machine learning huge amounts of what human beings do. We fear it because we don't know what to do with the human beings. But the post-capitalist project does know what to do with them. It pays them out of taxation, whether they work or not. Marx understood that capitalism is an unstable, fragile, and complex system. He recognized that class gives different agents in the market unequal power. But Marxism underestimated capitalism's capacity to adapt.
There's a character, I'd say almost the elephant in the room here. You haven't yet mentioned Karl Marx, but I think we have to talk about him. You characterize him in the book as somebody who was sort of very ahead of his time, but stuck in the 19th century. What do you mean by that?
A 21st century imagination in a 19th century brain. Okay, Marx must be applauded for coming up with the first coherent theory of crisis for capitalism. But Marx only lived through one of these big evolutions of capitalism. He knew he was living through a kind of survival moment and an upswing because it caused him a great deal of political angst. In 1848, he'd been a revolutionary. He's expelled from Germany, expelled from France, and finds himself in Britain, kind of nursing a massive revolutionary hangover. Why did it go wrong? And he concludes, from the evidence, it went wrong because capitalism is going through an upswing. But what he couldn't do, because he didn't have the telescope of history that we do, he couldn't see that this was a regular feature of capitalism. Now, one night, something like about 4 a.m., because that's when he was writing these notebooks, he writes something that's completely out of character. Marx's normal view of capitalism was that its final point would arise out of a clash between workers and bosses, but on this one night, he imagines something completely different. He imagines capitalism falling because we invent social knowledge, or as he calls it, the general intellect. All the knowledge needed to run the machines that run the economy can be stored in something called a general intellect, into which we all tap, from which we all draw general public knowledge. And Marx then imagines in this one scribbled notebook that we didn't even know about for the next 100 years, he imagines free machines that last forever. He says,
is he predicting the World Wide Web?
He's predicting software. He's seen the telegraph system. So he understands that the telegraph system doesn't work because there's thousands of little switches with thousands of men's and women's fingers tapping those switches. He understands it works because it mobilizes the social knowledge of all telegraphers in the world. He can't imagine software, but he does say, you know what, the ideal machine for capitalism would be something almost immaterial, something that never degrades, that costs nothing to produce, and that lasts forever. Well, software, and indeed knowledge in general, knowledge machines in general, I argue, conform to this description that Marx comes up with.
Okay, but if Marx was prescient in that particular area and predicted in some way the World Wide Web, or at least software, why isn't the kind of political analysis he made that he was so famous for in the three books of Capital, why isn't that useful in confronting where we are now in terms of capitalism or post-capitalism?
Look, it was Italian left-wingers in the 1970s who discovered this previously undiscovered notebook of Marx and went crazy about it because they said this changes the politics. We've been struggling away to try and overcome capitalism through workers v. bosses or waiting for the next crisis. And what we could achieve is to overcome capitalism by creating the social knowledge machine and placing that under the control of everybody. It redefined what being left-wing is about. Unfortunately, it wasn't read by everybody, and a whole bunch of normative left-wing activity went on, which tried in the old way. Look, I don't think we're going to find the solution in Marx either way. This one late-night scribbled notebook doesn't contain all the answers. But it points to the idea that instead of waiting for crisis to destroy capitalism, instead of waiting for a struggle between classes over scarce resources, what we should have been looking for is a technology that allows us to overcome, there's a technical term, sublate capitalism, that is, replacing it by something better.
Paul Mason read his way through the history of political economy in order to come up with the theory he expounds in his book, Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future. His writing is sharp, lucid, and, although sometimes technical, quite readable. That's not something you can say about the work of a lot of economists. But then, Paul Mason doesn't come from the academy. Before you began writing about economics and working as journalists in that field, you were actually something quite different. You were a musician and a music teacher, both in public schools and in a university.
I'd been brought up as a child musician and was okay, a decent trombone player.
There was music in your family as well.
Yeah, music on both sides of my family. I have an interesting background as the kind of working class side, the sort of northern English side were brass band players, and the Jewish Lithuanian side were dance band players in the 1930s. So between the two of them, I got the DNA for music. It allows me to bring to the work I'm doing now the mind of the brain of somebody who's got a lot of left-sided thinking, a lot of creativity, and a lack of fear about juxtaposing two apparently separate things. That's what musicians and creative people do all the time, and social scientists and economics gurus find it really difficult to experiment, to montage ideas together and see where they lead. I didn't study economics in a formal way, although I had an excellent schooling in economics in the university of the early 1980s, because I can remember studying Das Kapital with one of the leading academic authorities on it in a student occupation in Sheffield. So it's not like I started from scratch.
It's interesting, actually, when I began to ask you the question about music being part of your past, I could hear you laughing.
It's interesting that people ask you questions about your background that take you out of the zone you're supposed to be in. So the zone I'm in right now is I've written what I would call a book about economics that has annoyed a lot of people. And in addition to sort of defending the ideas in it against their annoyance, I also have to defend my competence to write it, because who am I? I went to a red brick university and studied music. It's that really that I was chuckling about, because the neoliberals got all the smart guys, they got all the quantitative analysts and PhD physics guys, but none of them spotted Lehman Brothers. And I have to say, me with my music degree, I kind of did.
It's interesting too, though. You say that the music background allowed you to invoke certain artistic sensibilities rather than scientific sensibilities, that you could bring to economics a kind of poetic or visionary almost outlook on what you're studying.
The fact that I didn't have to sit through three mind-numbing years of conforming to neoclassical equilibrium thinking just allows me to not worry and go out on a limb. I think what I've achieved here is an insight. And as I said earlier, I'm not the only one. There's a lot of people talking about the themes in this book. Lawyers, business gurus, economists have all said what I've said. It's just that I've said it with a greater degree of, I think, vehemence and maybe synthesis.
Okay, you actually said, though, that you've upset a number of people with this book, with what you said.
A number is an underestimation.
Okay, but I'm very curious.
A large number.
I'm curious about who they are. Are they mostly on what we might call the left, or have you upset the neoliberal
establishment? No, it's the right. The right don't like neoliberalism being called neoliberalism. They don't like the idea that there is a description of the world that encompasses America as it is, Canada as it is, Britain as it is, China as it is, and describes that as a whole system which has flaws. Well, I come from a school of thinking that used to be called dialectical materialism. I hate that word. I would call it complex thinking about reality. And in that form of thinking, we don't give static definitions. We give historically relative definitions. So what is neoliberalism? It's capitalism since 1990. To now 2015, and it worked at one point, now it no longer works. That is so annoying to many economic writers that they haven't got past chapter one. That's what chapter one of my book says, neoliberalism's broken. I'm a fair-minded person. If I read a serious critique of this book that says the main idea is wrong, the main idea about zero-priced goods, information being a different technology, the non-adaptation of capitalism, the need, and in fact, the tendency of work and wages to de-link. If somebody can come up with a, you know, point-by-point critique of that, I'll accept it. But this is the interesting thing. None of the people who attacked the book from the right even engaged with that argument. They just don't see it as economic. They see Wikipedia as the equivalent of a guy in his back garden shed playing with a train set. They don't even see it as an economic fact. On its own, the rise of infocapitalism would have offered a range of outcomes. You could just imagine a stagnant Western economy kept alive with high debt, bailed out banks and printed money, were it not for the demographic crisis. You could, without climate change, imagine a post-capitalist transition path led by the gradual, spontaneous rise of non-market exchange and peer production, alongside a system faltering under its internal contradictions. More Wikipedias, more Linux, more generic drugs and public science, the gradual adoption of open source forms of work, and maybe a legislative curb on the info monopolies. This is the airport book scenario for post-capitalism. A good idea, implemented in a crisis-free environment at a pace determined by ourselves.
On Ideas, I'm talking with journalist and political economist Paul Mason, the author of Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future. You claim in Post-Capitalism that information technology, things like the internet, are going to undermine capitalism. I want to know what you mean by that. How are they going to undermine capitalism?
Capitalism is based on scarcity, like all previous forms of economics. We call them modes of production. If you get an economy based on abundance, then it's not just Karl Marx who predicted you're going to get a different kind of economy. John Maynard Keynes, the guru of mid-20th century economics, also predicted it. He says the problems of allocating goods, the problems of markets, disappear. So all I'm arguing, it's not the internet, it's information goods. They are different. If I smoke 1 inch of a cigarette, you can smoke the next inch, especially if it's one of those cigarettes that people share, okay? But we can't both smoke the same inch of a cigarette. That's called a rival good. Same as we can't both park our cars in the same parking space without one of them getting crushed. But we can both use the same MP3 file, the same music track, the same software at the same time. The economist Paul Romer described this way back in 1990 as non-rivalry, and he said this is what makes information different to everything else. Because once it's produced, it can be reproduced for free. And this works whether you're a Marxist or a mainstream economist. If the resources going into something are zero, the price is going to be zero. And that's a revolutionary thought. Introducing zero and the zero cost effect into economics is as revolutionary as introducing the figure zero into mathematics. It creates new dynamics. And I simply argue that we have underestimated the rapidity with which the zero effect of zero price goods in information is trickling down into real stuff.
What I was led to believe, or am being led to believe, is that this new information revolution is going to free me up and I'm going to have more time to do things.
What's happened is that information allows two things to happen. It allows work and wages to become delinked. So nobody asks me, what time did you open the spreadsheet on the airliner? They simply assume I'm going to get my work done by the time it lands. Likewise, it allows work and non-work, that which we call life, to blur into each other. So we'll arrange our holiday flight on our laptop at work. We will also take calls from our bosses at midnight and answer emails at midnight. As a journalist, I'm answering Twitter as soon as I wake up. I literally lean out of my bed, pick up my cell phone and tweet. That's life for us. Now, what does it mean for the future of work? It means there's a struggle over time. But the struggle isn't the same struggle as in the 20th century between workers and bosses. It's a struggle to decide who shall control and determine the course of the automation that could now happen. The work of lawyers, the work of doctors even, is going to end up being automated. Leave aside the poor person in the burger joint who suddenly finds their front of house job is taken over by a touchscreen. We could be doing that a lot faster. I would argue we should. We should automate the world fast. But in order to do it, we're going to have to aggressively de-link work from wages. We need to pay people just to exist.
I would just think Paul Mason could run for prime minister almost anywhere.
You don't need a radical prime minister anymore. You already got one in Canada, but maybe.
Well, I get Justin on the phone and ask him if he's going to pay me to exist. I'll go for that.
Well, you know what? There are towns in Europe, Utrecht is one of them, that are experimenting with this so-called basic income scenario. There were actually experiments in Canada 20 years ago. The basic income is quite a popular demand from a whole number of people, green politicians, some right-wing politicians. But I see it having a very specific role in the transition beyond capitalism. Unless society picks up the can for people being chucked out of what were currently quite good jobs, then they'll cling to those jobs. Just as my dad's generation clung to their jobs in coal mines, we'll have the lawyer, the doctor, will cling to their job in the belief that only by doing that can they save their lifestyle. Society has to de-link livelihoods from work. You know what will happen if we don't do it? There'll be an almighty scramble for the jobs that are left. If you think there's a kind of gender war right now at work, there'll be an even bigger one when the number of jobs disappears. You'll have the guys fighting for them, you'll have the graduates, you'll have the elite, the entitled, the white male people fighting for what's left of work in a way that I think could be quite frightening unless we actually address it in a more rational way.
I want to go back to, again, something which is a more traditional way of looking at the world, certainly a more traditional among socialists, who said that, you know, that when the revolution came or when we were going to go into a post-capitalist world, it was going to be because the poor working classes rose up against the dominant rich classes. What we saw with the Occupy movement, it was the 1% versus everyone else, and it was all about how much you owned, how much money you had. But you're actually saying now it's not what you own in terms of capital, it's the mental capital or the intellectual capital, it's the information that really matters, and that a, quote, rich person will be somebody who has control of and knows how to use that information.
Once the world's based on knowledge, and knowledge is cheap or free, it's quite hard to be rich in knowledge. Knowledge is a great flattener of privilege and inequality. It's the physical things that drive inequality, and even there, we could do a lot to suppress the differences between the ultra-rich and the super-poor, which is what neoliberalism has provided us with. In terms of the path beyond capitalism, I've come to the conclusion that, you know, heroic and beautiful in many ways, though the workers' movement was for 250 years, it has not produced the project, the people, the kinds of action that are going to make this transition happen. I believe, as the Italian radical thinker Antonio Negri puts it, the new factory of the 21st century is the whole of society. That's quite a big thing to get your head around if you're from the traditional labour movement, because we were always told work is the basis of utopia. Work is where our strength comes from. Work is where we're all together. I think we have to move beyond utopias based on work, because there ain't going to be a lot of work in the utopian future.
I want to know how we're going to get there. Does it take deliberate action? Is it just going to happen on its own? It seems that a lot of these changes have been not necessarily under human control. And I guess looking back once again at how things happened in history, revolutions or changes like this have often not been altogether smooth and easy. Sometimes they've been pretty bloody. And do you see any of that?
You don't need to be espousing post-capitalism to be provoking and experiencing bloody conflict. There's a lot of that in the capitalist world right now. So what is the potential for post-capitalism? It is first and foremost to mobilize a human revolution. It is to say, from the knowledge, from the learning, from the incredible interaction we all have with each other through social media, we can begin to pursue a kind of change that will look more like 2011, with the Occupy, the Indignados in Spain, the Greek occupation of the squares, the Brazilian movement we saw in 2013, the occupations in Turkey. The movement, I think, that can deliver this is going to look more like those, which is You know, the sociologist Manuel Castells puts it very well. He said, look, they design the kind of society they want on the internet, they live it a bit on the internet, and then they take it into the squares or the public spaces of their own society and make it real. That's the kind of struggle I think is going to carry on happening. It will deepen. It will have to become more creative. It will have to overcome some of its annoying traits. But it will. That's the way we're going to have to do things. And what is built into that form of action is a far better safety valve against hierarchical, brutal, unthinking action than was built into the 20th century models of struggle that we associate with hierarchies, parties, unions, revolutionary guerrilla groups. These models, I think, don't fit with the kind of social and cultural revolution I think the 21st century is promising.
But how much do we know about it? I mean, I go back to that. You mentioned that when you wake up in the morning, your first thing you do is you start tweeting.
Well, I read other people's tweets.
And I would suspect, and I'll ask you out front here, as this interview comes to its close and the microphone goes off, what's the first thing you're going to do?
I will tweet. Or I will read my Twitter. And right now, here in the UK, obviously, you know, the Parisian story is still unfolding, and I want to know what's happening there. I want to take part in the conversation. The way I understand this little plastic and glass and metal thing in my hand, my smartphone, is not just as a device. It is an externalization of myself with all the ups and downs that has, with all the foibles, all the problems, and all the mistakes I make during the day. But I don't think I could go back. I think it would be like trying to de-electrify a country for me and my generation to go back to not having these devices, to not sharing and externalizing ourselves. The science writer Margaret Wertheim wrote in a book called The Pearly Gates of Cyberspace that we are creating leaky selves, selves that are no longer hermetically sealed off from one another. Now, that's a big, big mind-bender for liberal philosophy, because we assumed that the individual is a closed and sealed-off self with rights. Now, once you start to let yourself leak out, you can also have multiple selves. It's been fascinating for me to live alongside a young generation, my colleagues, my journalistic friends, who, you know, if you watch the movie Brief Encounter, it's about a man and a woman who have an affair and conceal it from the world. And they have two selves. And you talk to anybody young, they say, so what? That's, we have 10 selves. So we're going through a societal and generational change. And I think it's entirely apt that we should be changing the way human beings think and act and freeing ourselves up to more potentialities in the space of one generation that five generations before could ever even dream of. That's the confluence of technology and freedom. And I think if the price for it is that my hand automatically reaches out for my cell phone the moment I wake up, then I'll pay that price for now.
You're right near the end of the book. We need to be unashamed utopians. And earlier in this conversation, you called yourself a utopian. One reviewer actually took issue with that and said that we don't need to be utopians, that utopian thinking always leads towards catastrophe because it isn't really anchored in reality. Do you have to have your feet on the ground in order to have your head in the clouds?
You know what? The first thing I would say is capitalism is serving us up enough catastrophes without utopians. But I do accept that the problem with utopian thinking is not just the fact that it didn't have the material basis, it didn't have enough stuff, and it didn't have good enough people to make it work. There is, of course, a huge danger, not in utopias, but what I would call meta-narratives, being certain about stuff and having one story to tell the world. That's why in the book, I start out by saying, look, I don't have one story to tell the world. I have one question to ask the world, and that is, what would it look like if we mobilized the technological resources to free up human beings to be diverse, to pursue 100, 1,000, 100,000 different paths to the thing we all want, which was a good life and freedom? So if I could rip the final chapter out of this book and turn it into yellow post-it notes on a whiteboard, that's what I would do, because they'd be scribbled out the next day by somebody smarter than me. Teams working for 10 minutes could improve on most of what I say about what we should do. And since the book came out, I've had some incredibly fruitful discussions with experts in the relevant fields of distribution, of wages, of the precarious work, of environmental science. So I'm not handing down, let alone a tablet of stone, I'm not even handing down a single wad of post-it notes. I'm just handing down the post-it notes and saying, write them yourself. I think that's the best insurance against the meta-narrative, against the brutal and prescriptive utopia. And surely, of course, we have to. The entire literature of the last 400 or 500 years is littered with utopian writing that does, of course, warn against the danger of achieving one's dream.
Paul Mason, what happens if capitalism doesn't end, if post-capitalism, as you understand it, doesn't actually happen?
Look, capitalism might survive. It can survive in the form of big semi-feudal companies whose entire worth is based on their legal department, their intellectual property. It can survive, and if it does survive, there will be much greater inequality. It will destroy the planet. It will cause and revolutions and uprisings, and it will suppress them. Yeah, capitalism can survive, but I don't like the look of what happens if it does survive, because I don't believe capitalism anymore delivers the high-value synthesis of better work and better stuff. It's delivering inequality and almost the kind of feudalization of business life, where giant, unaccountable monopolies, really whose only rivals are states, are vying with each other to control ever more of the intellectual product that we give off as we interact, whether it's at the supermarket or on our Facebook page. I don't like that. I think, therefore, we should have the courage to think creatively of what human society could look like, and then ask ourselves how much of that can be delivered by the market. My conclusion is not all of it, and not all of it by states either. We have to deliver stuff through the market, the state, and the free, collaborative, cooperative, unmanaged space we call the commons. And I think that space is the one we have to expand just as aggressively as capitalism expanded the factory system 200 years ago. So we regulate for it. We prefer it. We give people tax breaks for producing high value, low input, collaborative stuff. And we don't give them tax breaks for producing low wage work.
Paul Mason, thank you very much.
And thank you.
Paul Mason is the economics editor of Britain's Channel 4 News. He also writes for The Guardian and The New Statesman. His book is called Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future. You can download the Ideas podcast through our website at cbc.ca/ideas. This episode was produced by David Gutnick. Associate producer Liz Nage. Technical production Dave Field and Sweeney. Our thanks to radio producer Lily Martin in our CBC studio in London. The executive producer of Ideas is Greg Kelly. I'm Paul Kennedy.
The self-belief of the 1% is in danger of ebbing away to be replaced by a pure and undisguised oligarchy. But there is good news. The 99% are coming to the rescue. Post-capitalism will set you free.